Hello and welcome everyone. My name is Arizuma Seni and it's a great pleasure welcoming to the New York Public Library tonight's distinguished guests, Joshua Dichter, writer, curator, and art historian, John Miller, artist and writer, Paul Ramirez Jonas, artist, Chelsea Haynes, curator and writer, and Ruba Katrib, curator. We are here tonight to celebrate the publication of Art is a Problem with a discussion and book signing. In this remarkable volume of selected essays, interviews, curatorial texts, and reviews, spanning from 1986 to 2012, Joshua Dichter examines contemporary art in relation to its various ideological, public, discursive, and social contexts. The book's seven chapters unpack art's paradoxical condition, being that art problematizes and is intrinsically a problem. From this standpoint, the author analyzes art's definitions, functions, ethical entanglements, societal aspirations, and cultural contradictions. I'd like to thank our guests for appearing in an Art Book Series event celebrating the essential importance of art publications with discussions and presentations by renowned artists, authors, critics, curators, gallerists, and historians. Copies of Art is a Problem are available for purchase and signing right after the audience Q&A session at the end of the program. Also, encouraging all of you to visit the art collection at Mid-Manhattan Library, located at 455 Fifth Avenue, where you can freely and openly browse one of the largest and most comprehensive circulating collections of books and videos covering every aspect of art criticism and theory. Thank you all for your attendance, and now it's time to turn the floor to our guests.
Thanks, everyone. I really appreciate it, and I think everyone really appreciates it. There's a lot of stuff happening.
Working?
Yeah? Okay. And so I'm very grateful that everyone's here. I'm just going to read a fairly brief introductory statement and then a brief, very brief extract from the book's preface, and then hand it off to John, who will read something briefly from his introduction to the book, and then everyone will be making statements and asking me questions, and then we'll have a conversation about the book and issues that the book has generated, and then we'll open it up for some Q&A conversation as well, and then we can sign some books as well if you're interested. I want to thank Arezou for reaching out to me some months ago to host this book event. As I mentioned to her at the time, as someone who was born and raised in New York, this was the first library that I went to, taken by my parents, as a child in the 1960s. So I sort of have a fundamental connection to this place as a public space, a place of learning that's accessible to everyone. I'm honored to be a part of the library and a part of the Art Book Series, needless to say, and wish that my parents were still around to see this. I think they would be quite pleased and even amused to a certain extent. And I suppose that it's guaranteed that at the very least, the Art is a Problem book will become part of the collection here, one hopes. I'm extremely grateful to John Miller, the book's editor, whom I've known for, I guess, approximately 25 years, give or take a few, for working with me on the book for on and off for at least a two-year period and putting up with my antics during an extended editing and re-editing process. So I'm profoundly grateful to John for being committed to me and the book. Without him, the book would not have happened. My thanks to Chelsea Haynes, Ruba Katrib. Ruba and I met when I was teaching at Bard and she was a student. To Paul Ramirez Jonas, Paul and I have known each other since the mid-90s approximately. Thank all of them for taking some time out from their very busy schedule tonight.
I also want to say that I'm really proud of Ruba and all for their professional accomplishments.
I see a lot more from her as she advances her career. John is already a famous person, so I won't
go on about him, but I'm very proud of Ruba. Working at the Sculpture Center as a curator and Paul with all of his success recently.
Of course, thanks to J.R.P. Ringer, the publisher of the book, and to our book Dave for being here and supporting the book
North America. I'm not going to
thank all the distributors internationally because it's an endless list, but there will be book events in Los Angeles in about a week and a half, and in London, Vienna, Berlin as well. If any of you are traveling to those cities during May. Something occurred to me this morning, hit me like a ray of light, something that was undoubtedly always repressed. No, I didn't find Jesus this morning, but I realized that my ambivalent relationship to art, institutions, and systems might stem from the fact
that I was dragged to museums
and galleries
as a kid by my parents. They
loved art, and they artists and hung out with the cultural intelligentsia, you know, 70s.
They made every effort
to transmit their love
of art to me.
And while
I did learn to love art itself, I didn't learn to love being inside of museums with my parents.
I always harbored some doubts about
frames. So at an early age, while I began to love art, I couldn't wait to get out.
The fact that I landed at the Whitney ISP program with artists such as Andrea Fraser and Mark Dion completely by chance in 1984-85, in which issues of institutional critique were already under discussion and development, is a bit ironic. But I think we did share this kind of wariness, ambivalence, and doubt. But I do trace that doubt to being dragged into museums as a young kid and falling in love with the art, but not the museum experience itself. My job as a writer and critic and occasionally curator, in a sense, I've thought, was to amplify the skepticism about art and its systems and institutions and frames, maybe to the point of anxiety. And as I suggest in the book, maybe to the point of self-exasperation. So I'm just going to read a quick excerpt, and then we'll move on. If art is a problem, this book does not claim to be a solution. And if this book creates problems, art may claim to offer remedies. Why title this selection of writings on art, curatorial practices, and other activities, Art is a Problem? Doesn't this risk marginalizing the book or engendering varying degrees of unease, confusion, fear, and loathing among the very communities and publics that would constitute the readership? Might the title even spur accusations of Philistinism? Or will the title be understood for what it is, a serious yet tongue-in-cheek provocation that invokes the manifold problematics of art? Needless to say, there are bigger problems in the world than art, but one has to start somewhere. Art may have become a problem only because it is no longer really problematic. Art, however we may choose to define, redefine, redefine, or undefine it, is on the verge of becoming so thoroughly assimilated into or integrated within global, social, economic, ideological, and institutional networks that I may no longer be able to pose any problems to those systems. As a result, art seems increasingly insulated from deeply critical questions that would seriously compromise its own validity or value. It is also tenable to suggest that this has been art's odd predicament for quite some time. A more difficult question to consider is whether art ever did pose any problems, and what criteria or metric would we use to measure this? Some would argue that art's assimilation, its distribution into broader networks, allows it to act, so to speak, upon the imaginations of broader publics and in increasingly complex, subtle ways than at any other time in recent history. To others, art's ubiquity merely tranquilizes its transformative potential. So I'll end it there. I don't want to go on forever, but I get the gist. Thanks. John?
Okay, I guess I'm up. Am I amplified?
Yes, you are.
Okay, good. Well, I too want to thank you all for coming, and one thing I have to say is that I'm relieved that the book is out, because one fear that I had, and I had this with my own recent book as well, is that it would come out as a PDF. And in fact, you know, with the economics of art publishing being what they are now, it's always gratifying to see something actually make it into print. And in fact, at one point, the book was a PDF, of course. That's the nature of producing books these days.
It still is.
Yeah, yeah, it's, the PDF is still here. Yeah. Anyway, in my introduction to the book, which I'll read from, I consider the relationship of Josh's writing to his curatorial work, and I think there's a close connection there, and that the two inform them. And one way I think we could think of Josh's work and his position as a whole is, to put it, the curating as a problem, and that when I think of the you know, large number of shows that Josh has done, they kind of depart from the norm in that they don't push towards a resolution, which is the normal expectation of what a curator should do. And I suppose the most vivid example of that would be Josh's show Adrift, which in some ways was a kind of reply to the what I considered to be the highly problematic high-low show at MoMA, which did attempt to achieve some kind of resolution that was worse than having no resolution at all in the definitions of different kinds of cultural boundaries. So anyway, I'll just read a couple pages from my introduction where I... in which I try to map out some of the relationships between Josh's writing and his development as a curator.
There are images of some of the exhibitions, but they're on a kind of endless loop cycle along with other images in the book up there. So it's not a didactic presentation.
Oh, but that is one thing I wanted to say about one of the earmarks of a lot of Josh's work is the integration of technology into the curatorial process in one way or another. But it's never from the standpoint of enacting like an absolute technological transformation. It's more a kind of what I consider to be a symbolic use of technology that points to the possibility of things being different. So that's one example of the kind of what I would call a kind of critical irresolution, I suppose. I don't put that idea forward in my text, by the way, so I'm just throwing that out there. This volume of selected essays, interviews, reviews, and curatorial projects spanning the period 1986 to 2011 represents a significant part of Joshua Dechter's ongoing work as an educator, curator, and critic. The writings form a discourse that engages the interrelationship of these vocations. This discourse is driven largely by a productivist vision of the artwork, to the extent that Dechter rejects the conventional dichotomy of form and content by which art is presumed to hold meaning like a vessel. Accordingly, he questions contemplative aesthetics and the baggage that goes along with it: quality, authorship, connoisseurship, and autonomy. These all reflect the principle of private property. In an age of ever more vigilantly policed intellectual property, for instance, if one owns an art object, does one also own what it signifies? Dechter instead sees the artwork from a public perspective and consistently probes its function as a collective representation, its placement in a cultural continuum, and the social relations organized around it. From fall 1984 through spring 1985, Dechter was a Helena Rubinstein Fellow in the Museum and Critical Studies in the Whitney Museum of American Art Independent Study Program. In this framework, he pursued a year-long individual tutorial with Benjamin H.D. Buchlo, focused on the work of Theodore Adorno, Louis Althusser, and others. Buchlo's grasp of the political implications of art made a deep impression on him. At the same time, Glenn Ligon, Mark Dion, and Andrea Fraser were enrolled in the ISP's studio section. They entered into an active dialogue with Dechter, marking the onset of his engagement with institutional critique. The texts in this book that address this most directly appear in the first section under the heading Institutional Critique, Rights Reserved, the symbol, and its discontents. This dialectical formulation registers one of Dechter's chief concerns, the omnipresent danger of how what becomes critical inquiry can be reappropriated and reified. He warned of such a prospect in his 1990 essay, Decoding the Museum, and here quoting Josh. Institutional critique has become a convention among other artistic conventions, thus the double bind of such work. When the artist incorporates that self-understanding into practice, the possibility of resignation emerges, particularly when the logic of the museum seems always prepared to incorporate difference and criticality within its neutralizing archive of historical information. The critique of the institution is thereby transvalued, and the fictionalization of history proceeds as usual. That same year, Dechter published an interview with Fraser where the artist put forward a notion of site specificity informed by psychoanalytic transference. Stressing the formation of subjectivity as a component of sight, she characterized transference as, quote, the supposition that another knows what one wants, that another possesses and can restore the lost object that causes that want or desire, unquote. Here, transference corresponds closely to what Dechter calls the fictionalization of history. Rejecting transference suggests that the artwork might function as an open-ended process of negotiation, a kind of porosity. Indeed, this is a quality that Dechter would go on to examine rigorously in his writing and curatorial work. So maybe I'll stop there and pass on to who's the next person?
Ruba?
I'm next.
Yeah. Okay. Ruba.
It's weird to be referred to as Dechter. But thank you.
I will call you Joshua.
Okay.
And yes, thank you everyone for coming, and I'm really pleased to be here talking around Joshua's book, which is fantastic. I urge you all to read it. And I just wanted to touch on a couple threads that run through the book, and I've formulated a few questions that were sparked in my reading of the book, and the multiple sections that are there. And the two threads that I would like to put together in light of current concerns are the legacy of institutional critique and its impact on curatorial work. So, in one of Joshua's essays, The Everywhereness of Art, he makes a few interesting statements which are echoed throughout some of the other texts. He speaks to the ubiquity of art, and I'm paraphrasing, and asks, is there any space?
So was I, actually.
Is there any space that hasn't been converted into a place, a location, a platform, a territory that functions as a venue for art? He also talks about the reanimation of strategies derived from 60s and 70s counterculture and political activism, and discusses this impact on the autonomous work of art, which he says must be sacrificed to usher in the collectivist or activist work. But then he also interestingly points out that these two modes, the so-called autonomous work of art and the collectivist work of art, are in fact two sides of the same coin. So another topic that Joshua speaks to is curatorial education, which is a site where we met, and how it has risen with the proliferation of biennials in the 90s. It had risen and continues to rise. And Joshua asks whether these programs were in the service of creating peripatetic and potentially innovative curators, while also questioning tuition and student debt in relation to job scarcity. So now I would kind of want to quickly go through like a little summary of, and then get to these questions. And I think we should start with, you know, conceptual art practices and exhibition structure, which I think is, you know, a predecessor for institutional critique. And Lucy Lepard has described the possibilities for exchange that opened with artworks that could easily travel, that were portable, where all you would need were instructions and a plane ticket, essentially, to install them, which reflected a necessity, but also was in an exhibition format that coincided with art production. So that opened a larger conversation up in different exhibition contexts and exchange between artists, but things started becoming lighter and lighter, or at least had the appearance of being portable, experimental, and flexible. So as we go through the 90s and the 2000s to now. And, you know, there are symposia like Curating with Light Luggage, which happened in 2005, which, you know, discussed this. This phenomenon, which also, so then once we follow the rethinking of exhibition structures originating from artists and then increasingly in collaboration with curators from conceptual art to institutional critique and on, museums eventually start to invite and encourage these practices, which touches on a whole slew of issues that Joshua also addresses in the book. For instance, the risk of creating art world insiders and a certain institutional absorption of criticality. So this phenomenon does connect to a term that is not raised within the book, but has been called new institutionalism, which is used more frequently in Europe than the US, but definitely has an impact here. And the new institution comes from a shift where the focus of institutions moves to privileging the creation of platform, sociability, and non-traditional exhibition formats. So this is simultaneously happening with the continued rise of biennials, the increased visibility, and myth of the independent curator. And I say myth because the most high-profile ones are usually tied to an institution, and the proliferation of curatorial programs, which is, you know, continues on and on today. So this also correlates with the type of curatorial work which has been called performative curating. So now that we've seen many of these projects through that were largely initiated in the 90s, and we are presumably now working within their wake, you know, there have been certainly major improvements in institutional responsiveness to a range of art practices and situations as a result, but what else has happened? So now this brings me to a few questions, which I don't expect to be answered or even addressed right now. But and these were questions that I've been tossing around, but were definitely inspired by the book as well, and you know, thinking up on the book. So, you know, this just makes me wonder, not only as Joshua asks in his book, if art is everywhere, perhaps it is nowhere, but also what happens when institutions privilege certain artistic and curatorial work? What's in it for them? For instance, what are the cost differences between organizing a platform and an exhibition? Do factors like time and money make it harder to justify the expense and resources it takes to do a complex exhibition of a contemporary artist in a small or mid-scale institution? Is this kind of scholarly work now only relegated to mega museums who have the resources to fulfill the expectation for constant programming and blockbuster exhibitions? If we are indeed experiencing increased expectations for more curating, range in curating, location of curating, and styles of curating, where are these expectations originating from? Audiences, boards, directors, artists, curators? Also through the increased institutional appeal of adjunct curators, guest curators, independent curators, Sputniks, agents, and other advisory and collaborative, but essentially temporary, arrangements for curatorial work, what kind of institutions are being built? How does this impact the art shown within these institutions? And how does this impact curatorial education? And finally, so has so-called innovative curatorial work or performative curating inadvertently helped keep contemporary curators under or unemployed and maybe still overworked? So, thank you.
Well, I'll begin responding, and we can chat off, after everybody goes. Chelsea, thanks.
Oh, okay, so I'm up.
Yeah.
Okay, curating is a problem, I guess, is the theme of the discussion so far, and I'm going to continue in that vein, I guess. So first of all, thanks to Josh for inviting me to respond to Art as a Problem. I haven't personally known Josh for very long, or at least not as long as the other panelists. But the circumstances of our meeting were unique and I think allowed us to have a rather frank dialogue right off the bat. So I'm happy to continue that conversation this evening. We were both participants of a curatorial research trip to Israel organized by Artis last October, and were sent together on a grueling but actually quite incredible itinerary. And there I quickly came to understand Joshua's thinking and therefore kind of the basic tenets of the book, which wasn't released yet at the time. But that basic tenet, I think, and Josh can correct me if I'm wrong later, is that at best what art and artists do is illuminate and complicate everyday, often invisible structures and hierarchies of power, yet at the same time art is often instrumentalized by the very systems of power it aims to critique.
That about sums it up.
yet at the same... okay, I guess we're done. In the sort of very complicated geopolitical context of Israel that we were in and where we met, that thesis, I felt strongly, was reinforced literally everywhere and in everything we saw, almost in the air we breathed, and thus became totally self-evident to me. So I became a believer. It was useful to my thinking on a kind of selfish level to have Josh there, who is not shy about asking big questions or making strong statements, as the title of this book attests, but also whose criticality I think is tempered by a really strong sense of curatorial ethics, which maybe we can talk about more later. So as I understood it, we were each tasked with tackling a particular element of Art as a Problem, and I was drawn to the section on the curatorial road, perhaps because of my own professional interests, but also because I think publishing a compendium like this allows the reader not just to better understand the arc of the author's own thinking, but perhaps makes the reader be better able to locate that author's work historically or within some kind of expanded discursive framework. While reading On the Curatorial Road, I wanted to draw a relationship between Josh's project and more generally what Iri Rogoff has coined as the curatorial. This expanded notion of the curatorial infers that exhibition making, which is the traditional realm of the curator, is one element of a complex practice that exists as much in the realm of ideas as with objects or art in general, meaning that the exhibition is only a partial manifestation of the curator's idea. The rest may be expressed through language, perhaps partially, in one way explaining the enormous growth of curatorial publications in recent years. I think in all publications of this sort, there is kind of an almost natural slippage between productive modes of self-reflexivity and unproductive self-referential modes of reflection, and we're all completely culprits in this to one extent or another. What I find really compelling about Josh's book and his work in general is that he has kind of, with this publication, I think, created a bit of a monster in a good way that attempts to tackle the professional and disciplinary questions of the curatorial and what it is, but relates that inquiry back into the nature of politics and power as it relates to art, the exhibition, and the art institution. So I wanted to bring up first a quote by an ethnographer and then an exhibition that John already mentioned a drift that Josh curated in 1996 at Bard. So as ethnographer Brian Durrance has pointed out, by and large, the curatorial turn manifests a curatorial engagement with politics that exists merely on a surface level. That is, on the level of subject matter of the work being represented. He asks, and I quote, "Is anyone convincingly suggesting how agitation over exhibitions and displays of work might contribute a solution of a far more reaching social inequities? Those curators and writers who argue as if museums are in the front line of political struggle implicitly deny the museum's history and complexity. Within the museums, the state, i.e. official power, is first detached from civil society, then discarded, leaving civil society alone split between reproduction and representation. Social reproduction and its intractable structure slip from view, leaving only symbols, i.e. the objects on display in the museum, which we are all expected to believe that the fuss is about when we really know it's about something else." So if we accept this basic proposition, the struggle for curators, ethically, becomes then how to marry reproduction and representation, i.e. form and content, to both lay bare the implicit value systems at play within the exhibition and to actively reshape them. So here I think it would be useful, again, to revisit Adrift, which was curated at Bard College in 1996, in this essay, and I'm going to quote Josh. And Josh, I'm kind of skipping around a little bit, but it's around page 408, so when you all buy the book, you can read it again.
turn to that page like we're in a religious service or something?
I think so.
Okay.
That would be great. Okay.
By the way, Ren and Stimpy were in Adrift in the television section. They were incorporated, but just by coincidence. So, yeah. It's 90s culture. Yeah.
Okay.
408?
It starts in 407, and then I'm editorializing you. Okay, the museum is alternately a real and artificial social environment. The metaphor of drifting has been used on a number of different but intrinsically related levels as a way to suggest that drifting and drift can be understood as rhetorical figures for how distinct forms and language pass through each other within the culture, how everything filters through everything else. There is a way to move beyond the exhausted binary opposition of high and low, to understand that culture dwells within society as a thoroughly porous constellation of practices, languages, discourses. Adrift is fundamentally about framing the continuous cross-pollination of visual imagination that can be identified in the gap between art-making and cinema, television, fashion, and other cultural languages. The avoidance here of what Svetlana Alpers calls the museum effect is achieved through a dual deployment of theatricality and exhibition display, recreating the exhibition space as an obviously fictitious or semi-fictitious site, and anthropology, the treatment of the work of art as analogous to other forms of cultural production. As John mentioned, the exhibition itself was a response to a 1990 exhibition at MoMA entitled High and Low, Modern Art and Popular Culture, curated by Kirk Varnadoe, who probably not incidentally also organized a primitivism and abstract art show at MoMA in 1984. And anyone with kind of a cursory knowledge of exhibition history can probably make the connection between what the problematic cultural hierarchies were in each exhibition.
I just want to say, Heinlo wasn't first. I mean, it was certainly, there was a huge amount of discussion and debate about it for a number of years, a compelling show. It wasn't necessarily the first and foremost thing that was on my mind. I won't say that I reacted to it directly. It was quite mediated, only because it had happened quite a number of years prior to developing, just to kind of, I'll respond a little bit, yeah.
No, I think I'd like to push you on that a little bit more, because I think that, I guess the hope is for people who are now trying to construct a history of exhibitions is that every exhibition that is produced in some way is in dialogue with another, even if it's not what we want to call a remake or a remedy or something like that. But maybe we can talk about that later. I would say that the major takeaway, though, of that exhibition for me as somebody who hadn't seen it, is that it's an exhibition that attempts to destabilize the category of art itself. And then the following question that I might have that relates to that and that you can maybe answer if we have time is that if, as curators, ethically, we are obligated to engage in a process of continual destabilization of the normative modes of reproduction of the museum, what remains at stake at all in maintaining the category of art?
Yeah, I like that question a lot. Thank you for that. Thanks, Paul.
Okay, I'm next. I'm going to write the time here to make sure I stay on time. But thank you for coming tonight. And I mean, I was looking at this book a few days ago, and I think I'm sort of as the artist in the panel, I guess that would be my role. And what is, was also John, but I'm saying, I'm the artist speaking, not. But in any case, what I was thinking is what is, I realized that the chronology of the essays dovetails almost exactly to the year from the time that I've been an active artist. So in a way, these writings parallel a moment in history where, like, I wasn't, or I have been an artist as well. And I was thinking about the moments when I met JD, because we've called him Josh, Joshua, and Dector, so I'll just call him JD. So, and how, when I met him really formally to engage in discourse, not just as a casual formal thing, there was a moment of crisis in what I perceived in the world of art in New York, but also in my own practice, in that a lot of his essays actually addressed those crises. And I thought, we met during Insight 2005, which was a show, that's when we really met as, or I met Josh as a public intellectual, rather than as someone that you socially see in the art world. You're like, that's Josh Dector, hello. And he was involved in the show in many ways, but he was very involved in the show as an interlocutor, given the artist kind of a sounding board critique. What was that exactly? Something like that. And it's interesting because as an artist, you want to be part of discourse, and that's really what maybe you're secretly yearning for. But Josh is a scary person to be in discourse with because it's you're really going to get real discourse, right? It's not just going to be like a review, good review, bad review. He's a public intellectual. He's trying to connect work to the works of art to larger ideas. So it's not just about check marks, you know, good, bad. And what I thought that was happening with Insight, at least with myself, having grown up in the same time period artistically, was one is that the world of art was beginning to drift away from being a small world where you could feel like things were a call and response. Even if you didn't know people personally, you kind of knew everyone because maybe there were 5,000 people. So you could know people by sight, or you could know that one show was in response to another show, or that one work was in response to another work. So there was the beginning of something that we have now, which is a kind of a true industry, right? We have an art industry, and tried to figure out how to deal with that. The other one was, in my view at the time, was also the complete dissolution of cultural critique, where I grew up on cultural critique, but after 10, 15 years of cultural critique and institutional critique, you start to wonder, well, if the very same institutions that are putting this forward are not changing themselves, then how effective is this? So there was, at least in myself, a loss of faith in that. And also, what was the other crisis? And I think also that I think it was at least in my mind, a project to dismantle an idea that there was a kind of art and that we could have a kind of plurality of arts going at the same time. And that actually seemed to have been achieved by 2005. But then the question to many of us was like, well, where's rigor going to come from now? If we finally arrived at a moment where, of our own doing, where we want to say any kind of art is okay, then what happens now? So the size of the art world, the fact that there was an atmosphere that any kind of art could be okay, and that critique was not necessarily working as everyone thought it was going to work out, to me that created like a weird moment of crisis, and that is really when we started talking to each other formally. And fortuitously, Inside 05 was a really challenging show where artists had to commit to go to the border region of Tijuana and San Diego for 2 years for a minimum of 6 visits. You did those two. And I think I ended up going 12 or 14 times and just is kind of trying to figure out what is possible. And I don't want to go too long into that, but I thought what was really interesting about Josh is that in the last paragraph of something he wrote about Inside 05, he said, about the show, it was 20 artists who did interventions in this space between the two countries, is that he said of the show, it also offered a good faith, succinct argument to why it is still worth considering the possibility that in certain situations, at particular moments, with good networks of local support, and with artists who are willing to continuously and responsively rethink their practices, art can be a useful agent to reactivate utility of culture. And I thought this was quintessential Josh Dechter, because he really does believe in art tremendously, but there's all these conditionals. It's like, I believe in it, but if this happens, if there is good faith, right? So there's good intent, if there's cooperation, you know, if there's commitment on the part of the artist, and then there's hope, you know, like, then maybe this can be achieved. And I think that that kind of stance is the kind of rigor that these times are sort of asking for. That's sort of my bit.
Thanks, Paul. Is that a question? I'm sorry. I'm
kidding. Is this no. The kind of rigor?
Yeah. Well, let me see if I can kind of respond in different ways to the various issues that were brought up and the various questions that were raised. I do think that there is the ethical turn. So I don't like using that phrase. I don't really know what it means. I mean, there should always be an ethical turn, right? I mean, it shouldn't be a period. It shouldn't be a genre, so to speak, or art historical periodization. And so, as somebody who came up, you know, as an art critic and a curator from the mid-80s onwards, Richard Martin, who was the editor of Arts Magazine in the mid-80s, God rest his soul, gave me my first writing opportunity in arts, and I was like, wow. And, you know, I think, like, I don't want to dwell too long in that prehistory, but, you know, I did think that criticism had a particular vocation at that time, a few of the earlier pieces that are reproduced in the book were quite kind of violent attacks, so to speak, on sort of patriarchal figures. Judd, for example, I lashed out at in 1986, just because I thought that the work was just simply, you know, not what folks thought the work was. And I did that partially because I believed in what I was writing, but also because I thought that was the role of the critic also to generate attention to oneself, you know, in terms of, I mean, anybody who's involved in the arts for long enough is a bona fide narcissist in one way or another. I mean, leaving aside the psychoanalytic discussions about narcissism. So, you know, I thought that criticism had a role. I thought that what people like Harold Rosenberg did was very important. I thought that it still had a vocation, still a function to challenge, you know, not only broader authorities and power and hegemonies, but also authorities vested within canonization of artists. And I think that's still something that I've been working on. It's not made me a very popular figure with some people, but the ethical issue is that having grown up in the art world and having my share of mistakes, you know, as a professional, in terms of, you know, things that I wish I had done differently, I learned from those mistakes and those errors of judgment in terms of various things as a curator, as an administrator, as an educator, so on and so forth. And I think that one eventually either one learns from one's mistakes and errors of judgment, or one doesn't. And so for me, there's been an attempt to be open and transparent about, you know, the contradictions that we all in some way encounter and embody working within the broader contradictions of art and in relation to these broader conditions, whether it's as curators, as critics. And, you know, the reason for the title and whether it's curating as a problem or art as a problem, it has to do with, yes, problematizing everything now, including art as a category, as a condition, and my worry about the kind of ubiquity or even hyper-ubiquity of art as something that, if it is so ubiquitous, and if it does migrate into the broader culture, maybe that's not so interesting any longer. And for me, I think with the Adrift exhibition, there was still something, and Ken Saylor is here, who is one of the co-designers with Judith Barry, and we had many discussions about the place of art and the place of what was described as non-art materials in this exhibition. And they come up with a particular design approach to this, which was quite compelling, and it wasn't a resolution to these problems or categories or questions, but it did clearly problematize what we mean by art and what we mean by non-art or other kinds of cultural materials. And these questions continue to persist, particularly in the realm of, you know, of ubiquitous social media and the breaking down of category, or the apparent breaking down of categories and boundaries, and the multiple art worlds that are sort of being generated, you know, in virtual worlds, you know, to use an old-fashioned term, and the kind of simultaneity of everything that's happening beyond the pluralism, I think, that Paul is referring to, beyond the pluralism of the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, we have a different kind of hyper-pluralism today. So, I mean, I think that and clearly there's a lot of writing about what we mean by art today. Whether we can leave it behind to a certain extent, that word. I mean, I think that perhaps new words, and not words that include the word art in them, like post-art, or just leaving aside art itself as a word and coming up with other kinds of means of communicating what we mean by a certain kind of activity might be worthwhile to consider. In terms of curating, I started curating... first, because I got a job at PS1 when I was really young, and I was like, it was a very romantic thing, curating and meeting artists and doing things and traveling and so on and so forth. But then at PS1 and working there, I realized that there was something about institutionality and institutional life that I didn't feel quite comfortable with. And I think that part of it had to do with thinking and writing about the problem of institutional critique. But it was brought home to me working within an institution, the kind of frictions and tensions that unfold, right, and on a pragmatic basis every day and still do. But really to function as an extra institutional curator or independent curator was really to do things that I couldn't accomplish as a critic or a writer or an educator, to put things into a kind of materialized form and occasionally dematerialized form that I couldn't accomplish in other ways. It was very straightforward. And maybe to perform so-called a certain kind of criticality as a curator, testing formats, testing models, testing genres, testing structures of presentation display, and as John was suggesting, and Chelsea and others, utilizing media or immediate forms of mediation to sort of problematize standard, what I saw as standard practices within the form.
Can I interject with
sure.
a question?
Sure, sorry.
Are you working on any curatorial projects presently?
Yeah, that's interesting. I get asked that question all the time. How do I respond to that? Yes and no. I recently was asked by a magazine called Moose. It's not the animal, but the dessert topping, or it's the Moose magazine. It's an Italian publication. I was somewhat familiar with it. I had read a little bit of it in the past. But they reached out. They were doing some, you know, nebulous issue about the future of everything, right? So they reached out to me as a kind of neo-futurist, I suppose, and to ask about the future of institutions or curating or art, and one of the questions was, well, so what are you working on? What have you been doing lately? You know, And so what I wrote was a piece called Hallucination Museum, which is in the current issue of Moose Magazine. I wrote about how I wanted to collaborate with neuroscientists and technologists to develop a pill that one could drop, and take in lieu of going to see exhibitions, that one could actually experience an exhibition, as almost like a trip. Exhibitions. This could be engineered in particular ways. So that's my long response to that question, that if I have an opportunity to collaborate with neuroscientists and neuroengineers on that kind of pill or series of tablets, that might be the next curatorial endeavor. But I found that after the Dark Places exhibition, which is sort of in here, which I sort of pushed the form to its kind of maybe a certain kind of form of mediation to a kind of, it was in Santa Monica Museum in California. It didn't, unfortunately, get to New York, even though there was a significant amount of effort made. And I think that's an interesting kind of problem is, why that particular exhibition wasn't able to be seen in New York, but, because perhaps of the form that it took and what it asked of viewers to experience. But I sort of pushed format perhaps to as far as it could go in a certain way, and have now been sort of functioning in a more abstract way, maybe discursively, organizationally and discursively, perhaps more.
I have a question, I think both for you, Josh, and John. I kind of want to push you on what you mean when you speak of porosity, because I think I theoretically understand what you mean, but how do you actually make that happen in an exhibition or a text? What is the porousness of your practice? And I think, John, you talked a lot about that in the text.
Well, one way to think about it is just as a matter of dialectics, that nothing is essentially one thing or the other, but the identity of a thing happens in relationship to something else. And I think in a drift, partly through the exhibition design, partly through the choice of what was presented, that was that dialectical condition was presented as a kind of allegory in a way. So, for example, in the design, there was a periscope motif that appeared in many of the rooms, and obviously, we don't go to an exhibition literally to look through a periscope, but the periscope was an allegory of being in one space looking into another. So it implied a connectedness of discrete spaces. That might seem paradoxical, but that was the one way to emblematize porosity.
Yeah, I mean, it was a term that came to mind, porousness when I was sort of thinking about the exhibition and writing that particular essay for the catalog, porosity or the condition of porousness. One can use other terms or words to describe that, but there was an attempt made to literalize, of course, through as one has to do through exhibition design, to move beyond the symbolic and the allegorical through particular kinds of moves that are made within transformations of the space itself, which the term that was produced by Ken and Judith was Swiss cheesing of the walls, which was to drill holes literally into the walls of that particular museum space so that one could look from one room to the next, right? So to literalize that kind of movement from one part of culture to another part of culture, right? But then that literalization allows us to move back to more broader symbolic possibilities. But it's a construct, right? It's a reframing of the frame, right? It's an inflection of an extant frame, and a reinflection of that frame. And I tried to make that clear in the essay in certain ways, and in And I think it is made clear, or was made clear, in the exhibition design. But it was also a very big group show at the same time, which had different kind of subjects or thematics, which also bled into each other in successful and sometimes not as successful ways. And I think also the idea that at that time that BARD was sort of emerging as a space of it was designed initially as a space for not only a curatorial program but also a collection, but also as a space for so-called curatorial experimentation. And so there was the real effort made to take advantage of that as a space, because I don't think that exhibition could have happened, frankly, anywhere else in New York at that time. Quite candidly, I don't see it happening in any other institution. Couldn't have happened in a gallery or an alternative space. It just wouldn't have happened in that way. So I think, I don't know if that's, but I mean, it is, you take it with a grain of salt, right? Porosity.
I just thought it was a really compelling word to use rather than dialectics, for example. And there's something very visceral about it too.
Yeah, I mean, it does. It comes out of certainly thinking about dialectics for me, as you know, coming up through, you know, obviously Marxist theory and other variants of that, without question. But it does try to push it into a kind of, I won't say I don't know what a post-dialectical condition really means, but certainly something beyond the dialectical to a certain extent, yet embodying that as well. And I don't know, I often like talking about the critical reception of that exhibition, because I think that, this is the case whenever we do things as artists, as curators, as writers, there's always going to be a mixed bag of receptions. But it's interesting to me that I was like extremely excited and shocked that the Adrift was written about by Roberta Smith in the Arts and Leisure section on a Sunday in a major article, which is like shocking to me. And it actually, my parents realized that maybe I was doing something right or correct. Maybe, just maybe. I wasn't really making any money, but at least I was in the Arts and Leisure section, which is something that they understood was important that they read, you know, on Sunday. So, but it was interesting that Roberta, you know, who I respect, and she wrote on basically everything that I did curatorially, which is very happy about. And I think that being negative and critical is part of the game, because I've been negative and critical, and you know, if you can't take it, get out of the kitchen. But it was interesting. Her basic thought was that there was too much going on, that there was a kind of I won't say accelerationist, because that's a whole other discussion today, but that there was too much distraction from art, right, in the exhibition context. And when I look back at Adrift today, and I think, my goodness, it's very tame. And I actually think it was kind of, not tame then, but I think that we wanted to go further. We had restrictions by the museum because of infrastructural questions, and I think there was a sense that, well, just, you don't want to go too far, but we went pretty far. I don't think that there was distraction from the art. I think actually that it amplified. I mean, I think it did create this kind of interpenetration, maybe is another way to put it, you know, of art and certain materials that seem to represent other parts of culture and other kinds of cultural production, television, cinema, you know, album covers, Keanu Reeves, whatever the heck.
Well, distraction from art seems to be missing the point of the show.
Well, I think she approached it in a more traditional way. And yeah, I think that perhaps there was something missed there. Yeah.
Was Pierre Bourdieu's mapping of different cultural fields also a kind of impetus for how you organized that show?
Indirectly, yeah.
I mean, it occurred to me, because there, like, the opposition of cultural fields isn't about porosity, but it's about exclusion in a way. So it seems that the show wasn't completely porous. And if one thinks of the operation of a subculture, for example, subcultures define themselves by the inability of people who are not inside the subculture to recognize what the signifiers are. So it's not all about an open embrace either. Mm. You know, that there's like tensions that structure what these different sites are.
Absolutely. No, I think that certainly the inclusion of other kinds of materials, and the way that they were included and how it was framed and designed and also how the art was hung did suggest, you know, there were reciprocities and inclusions and those kinds of distinctions, to, you know, invoke Bourdieu, that were crucial. I mean, there was a segregation to a certain extent between that which we considered to constitute non-art and that which constituted art, at least as a spatial construction. But I mean today, I mean, Paul, you were sort of talking about this indirectly in terms of questions of social practice, right, to get back to that. Well, whatever we mean by that, and there's a long history, and some of it's discussed in the book, indirectly, but I think it's interesting that in the 80s and the 90s, certainly, there was a huge amount of conversation about the relationship of art, visual art, contemporary art, to mass culture, popular culture, what have you. I mean, it certainly extends much further back to the 60s, at least, 50s. And I think that's really been sort of largely left, I mean, leaving aside, you know, the whole question of the celebritization of contemporary art through, you know, banalities like the James Franco, you know, remaking of Cindy Sherman thing, which I do not consider to be art per se, by the way. It's something else, which is okay, but it's not art. I know this sounds very reactionary, but be that as it may. But I think that kind of the interpenetrations of art, popular culture, mass culture, theoretically has been subsumed by or moved beyond in terms of the question of art moving beyond itself to become something else within the broader social field of relations. And where, you know, at what point does art lose its art condition and become something else? And maybe the debates around social practice connect to that question. And this has been ongoing, again, for a number of decades. Capra, for example, and many others in terms of participatory collaborative practices as well, which I am both fascinated by, have been involved in, have supported to a certain extent, but have also felt the need to push back and to question. Right? But that's just sort of kind of the job part of my brain. My pushback has really been about, and I think Paul brought that up, the questioning the legitimacy but the viability of some of the claims that are made for certain kinds of practices, whether it's social practice, whether it's participatory collaborative practices, or whether it's, you know, anything else.
Well, it's interesting because the word ethics and ambivalence have been used to talk about you tonight, and I think like they go together. Like, I feel like you do think, sometimes in the sense that you do think art is a problem and you like to put it to the test, right? Like, you're like, well, can it really do this thing that it says it can do, in conversations I've had with you or things, or even the joke about the pill or the reference to the pill is like, well, can we have it without the work, right? Can we have it with the pill only? And I think that's the question about rigor was that what I enjoy is like you're right. He's not shy to ask like the question that everyone's thinking about but no one's going to say because it's too devastating, maybe, right? So even the title of the book is great in that way. It's like it has that ambivalence. It's like, is art no longer a problem? Is art a problem, literally, a problem as in a negative, or is art a problem that we can still solve?
Well, one thing I want to say, though, and this goes to, I think, also the question of social practice and social media, and I think there's that interesting kind of drive that's going on, the sort of simultaneous drive of social media on the one hand, social practice. And I found that, and I'm very much, I have to say that my preoccupation now is, in terms of ethics, is with debt, indebtedness broadly as a problem in this country, particularly student debt. A lot of the activists and younger, predominantly younger generation people involved in the arts and culture who are activists and bringing this to the table, to me are really crucial issues of labor and pay for artists and writers and critics. Those issues to me are the key issues of the day. Surveillance and how, you know, the Orwellian issues. I mean, yes, those are key, but I do think in terms of ethics, you know, it's labor, it's pay. It's inequities of income. It's what's happened to the city in terms of economic inequities and I won't even say, you know, and hyper development. And to me, those are really the issues that I'm concerned with today. And whether or not art and curating, from my point of view, can in any satisfactory way engage those key issues, I'm not sure. I do think that activism can. And whether it's activism by artists and curators, or whether it's activism by people who don't self-identify as artists, curators, or critics, or scholars, it doesn't matter. But I do think that this kind of activism is crucial today, given what's happening in my city, which I barely recognize on occasion. I mean, I recognize the New York Public Library, but that's, you know, that's... So, I mean, to me, those are kind of the key issues that are at stake. And if... what we do as professionals can provide platforms for those kinds of discussions and debates and for progressive change, all the better. And if they don't, perhaps all for the worse.
Well, this is a riveting discussion, and I think it's a good time to open the floor to questions from the audience. We are audio recording the event, so raise your hand and I'll bring the microphone to you.
Hi. A few people tonight have mentioned the sort of growth of the art world over the period represented by the book. So from the mid-80s to now, the idea that it's now sort of an industry as opposed to a smaller community. And I wonder if anyone, I guess Josh or anyone else, has thoughts on the way that shift has impacted criticism and the importance of critics and discourse in general, I guess.
I'll just try quickly and then... let others address. I mean, John and I started doing a journal partially due to the pressure from the late Colin DeLand, a little bit in collaboration with Andrea Fraser at the time, and called Acme Journal, in which we were sort of part of what we wanted to do was sort of address the question of, at then, in the early 90s, the crisis in art criticism. I mean, that was one of the things that we wanted to do, right? I mean,
it's important to note that most of our meetings are given over to titling the magazine.
Right, exactly, yeah, which, yeah. And some of those meetings were with Colin, some with other, not, and some with Andrea. But, I mean, I'm just saying that those issues, they're recurrent, right, and recursive and recurrent and perennial. Not to say that they're not important. They remain important. You do your best to address them at a given time, in a given period, and I think that to a certain extent it is a generational problem in that there are folks, you know, who are now practicing criticism on Yelp, like, you know, Brian Drotkir and others. I mean, that is migrated in terms of, you know, social media. It's the acts of criticism, whatever that means, have migrated into different platforms and into different kind of spaces, and the question always is, you know, how is meaning produced? What is impact? What is effectiveness? What is affect? And so on and so forth. And these questions are the most difficult to address, which was sort of, in my preface, I try to get to the why I'm so exasperated often as a critic is, well, okay, what sort of impact is being made, other than either people being alienated by something that I've written, you know, or disalienated, so to speak. But these are the great questions, I think, regarding criticism still. But I do think that for me, criticism is not necessarily, you know, writing for a particular magazine, but it's still a kind of critical, in an old-fashioned way, a kind of critical consciousness that you carry with you, you know, and you wake up with and you go to sleep with and you dream about and dream with, for better and for worse. It's extremely stressful to have critical consciousness, particularly these days. So that's how I would kind of address that.
Well, also I think the scale of the art world can be looked at in a kind of critical historical perspective because I think it's linked to globalization and, one of the... I think principles at work with the kind of profusion of biennials, for example, comes into being in the wake of the Second World War in the degenerate art show that was organized by the Nazis. And I think a kind of, in opposition to that, a kind of biennial culture has slowly grown because the assumption was, which I think is partly erroneous, not that we should like be branding art as degenerate, but that you know, a nation state that supports advanced art, that's a kind of a biennial can serve to kind of legitimate that nation state as a liberal democracy. So we've seen, you know, a huge spread of interest in contemporary art, and also a transformation of museum culture. When I got out of art school in the late 70s, the kind of cliche about museums was that was a place where art went to die. And now, you know, in terms of attendance, in terms of public interest, museums are like extremely vital. They've become, you know, after Bilbao, they can be shown to regenerate cities. You know, so it's a much different kind of set of priorities. And then I suppose going along with globalization, there's a new class of capitalists and collectors. And just like art can serve to legitimate a nation state, it can also show someone's cultural worth. And that's another form of legitimation that's spreading. So that those are some of the factors that's produced a larger art market. I think some of the negative results of that is it's harder to get an overview. Everyone's working with, you know, different versions of the art world, but it's also been reflected in the kind of biennials and documentas we have now, where there's a kind of more is more aesthetic, so or curatorial approach. So, you know, now a documento will include a film program, panel discussions, lecture series, and I spent 3 days at the last documenta. My version of it is different than other people who I've checked with. You know, so what does that mean for public discourse when people don't have like the same version of the same event? You know, a certain kind of like common space is lost. I think that's one kind of crisis of public space that we're facing. You know, another has to do with incursion of technology, which on the one hand allows for like a spread of information, but also, you know, with various devices, it can privatize even like last vestiges of public space. And I think in connection with that, Josh's idea of the curatorial pill, I'm curious if different people who take the same pill, will they see the same thing or different things?
It would be a bespoke pill. It would be engineered for your individual, you know, tailored to your individual.
Yes, yeah, so I'm curious because on the one hand, that does reflect a kind of conceptualist live in your head notion, mm-hmm. but also it does away with architecture and it does away with public space.
Well, it deals with a different kind of spatialization and a different kind of architecture. Put it that way, the architect, you know, other kinds of architectures. But I think it's interesting the kind of the John was sort of talking about even a kind of a Rashomon approach to things. So that you know you're having so does you know the Kurosawa film Rashomon, just, and people having multiple versions of the same event in a kind of forensic sense. I do think certainly has been there since I've been involved in the art world in one way or another, but it has been amplified without question. And I think that the incorporation of discursive platforms certainly has added to this when in fact, I mean, you have 100 days, for example. I guess Catherine David initiated this perhaps within her documentary. We have 100 days of events. It's just that the exhibition itself becomes sort of respatialized in a way that it's simply incomprehensible as a whole. I mean, I think that yeah, it has its. I mean, I think that's also the question in the question of artists working in particular remote locations, whether it's in, you know, the border of San Diego, Tijuana, in terms of more sort of site-oriented, context-driven projects, in which, you know, in InSight, the challenge was to not only for artists to kind of connect with people there in that region, but also then to have publics and audiences connect to what artists were doing in that situation, either bringing, you know, busing people in to sites and locations, or conversely, bringing artists out to particular communities. So I think you have these kinds of interesting, I would say, sort of conjugations, so to speak, or respatializations of the exhibition happening in different ways. I don't know if Chelsea and Rubo. Yeah,
I want to go back to your size question in a way, right? And I think for me, what's bittersweet and ironic is that I felt there was a moment maybe in the 90s where I felt like, oh, we're all collectively working towards the same thing to dismantle modernism, to make things more inclusive.
You want to use your
right, like
your
different
thing,
kinds of voices. Oh, more people making work. And then I can't tell the cause and effect apart from each other, but you couldn't imagine an art world this big with this much money if there was only one kind of art that's the art that's okay to make, right? So both the confluence of more people wanting to be artists, more ways of being able to be an artist, the dismantling of modernism, all these things, the confluence is now that it's huge and you can't get an overview. But I feel like there's a vestigial sense among art practitioners. They're like, this is okay, right? But there's also this, like, maybe this is not okay. But at the same time, it's our own doing. So I think it's a funny moment for... I mean, I want to know what the next book is going to be about.
Absolutely. And on that note, thank you so much for this provocative discussion. And it's time to move on to book signing.
Really? We can't have a little bit more, just a little bit more chat?
It's time to get going, yeah.
Okay.
You're just getting into it.
Well, you know, but also you want people to read the book, right? This is the best time.
I wanted Chelsea and Ruba to have an opportunity to respond. Just can we just have like 5 minutes each,
okay,
please?
Go
Thanks.
For it.
Thank
okay.
you. Sorry, just 5 minutes. Yeah. Is that okay? Unless, yeah.
I'll respond for you.
Okay.
I just think that question, I think it's really... You know, it's more, I think community becomes really essential, and you do see different communities operating in different spaces, geographic, you know, virtual, and therefore it is hard to get an overview, but I think that there are very distinct things that are happening and distinct conversations being had that are worth examining. And so I think it just takes more time, which is something people have less of, so...
Yeah, there are multiple events happening tonight all over the place, literally. And where do you, how do you deal with that?
Oh, okay. So I should respond. I don't really know if I have a way of resolving these issues that you're bringing up. I totally agree that there's this this basic understanding now that we cannot encapsulate the world in the way that we maybe once thought that we could. Yet at the same time, I feel like the overwhelming trend in curatorial practice is to try to contain the world in an exhibition, or at least contain... It's off. Oh, no, it's back on again. Okay. Anyway, I think that if any of you have gone to see the Whitney Biennial, you'll have noticed that in each of the curatorial texts that are written by the three curators on the different levels, they all kind of claim this frustration of no longer being able to contain everything, every trend that's happening in the art world. And yet at the same time, in their curatorial practice, they absolutely are kind of continuing to maintain that status quo of... trying to include every possible trend. So I don't know if it's if anybody has really attempted to try to resolve that in a biennial or project recently, but it's something that maybe Josh can do as his next curatorial project after the museum.
The next book that's coming out is a book on exhibition histories, on culture and action, which is kind of the Culture and Action 1993, the After All series on exhibition histories, and that's sort of kind of going to deal with the evolution, if you will, of participatory, community-driven, context-driven, collaborative, collectivist, and sort of the origins, if you will, of social practice and artists who participate in that. So that's the next co-authored book that's coming out, and I think the next, maybe I will do a children's book, though, frankly, in the next iteration. Thanks.
Sounds great. Thank you so much. No, thank you so much. Okay.